Welcome, travelers. We're aware that your journey was difficult, but prepare to have your questions answered, for you have been granted an audience with the Masters of Modern.
And welcome back to Masters of Modern. I am your host, Alex Kessler, here with my co-host, Ben Bateman.
What's up, guys? How you doing?
And today, for the second time, we have Travis Wu of...
Woo! What's good?
How's it going, Travis?
Good. Thanks for having me on again, as always.
Yeah, man. Welcome back. This is great. Like, I think since you came on, that had to have been, like, what, at least 12 weeks ago or something like that. We've talked brews a little bit, and we've actually almost been, like, established a little bit now as, like, a modern brew cast in some ways. We've had some interesting discussions, so it's cool to have you back.
I mean, you've been established as a modern brew cast.
I went back and listened to the episode again to make sure I wasn't going to be redundant with questions, but I found myself listening to the whole episode. It was a good episode. You had great answers last time, so hopefully we can get a great sequel going.
Yeah, so that's pretty much just a plug. All of you guys listening, go back, listen to that one, now listen to this one, or listen to this one first, then that one. I don't think there's going to be any information that you need to know, but...
No. Yeah. We have a very unique episode today, so this should be a lot of fun. We're going to talk... Few things. We have card interaction.
We have two like philosophical questions, and then it's going to be followed by like quick lightning round. We got a bunch of cards from people on the Twitterverse, and they've asked what cards are like cool and unique for modern. And we're going to talk about what kind of decks those possibly could be good in, and then we'll wrap it up with some wrapping upness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, before we get started, I do want to let everyone know on the internet that you can follow us at the MMCast. Go tweet us right now, then come back, then listen. Twitter and also email us. We have the MMCast@rocketjump.com. Let's get started. I guess the first question is, what is card interaction? I know that you had a long, and I think I was part of that debate on Facebook and Twitter a month or two ago, and I wanted to kind of break it down on the podcast. So, Travis, what is your definition for card interaction?
So, I mean, there's card interaction and there's player interaction. When we think of an interactive experience in playing games, we think about getting to make a lot of decisions generally, right? If it's interactive, we think decisions, right? Is that...
Right. Yeah, I'd agree that...
Sure, so, I mean, the most interactive cards are cards with multiple choices. So charms and commands and things are like the most interactive because you get tons of choice, right?
Well, I'd say, yeah.
Yeah, it feels interactive. And when we don't get to do anything, we didn't get to interact. It felt like... an uninteractive game, yeah. Certain decks don't provide much decisions to the opponent, and we call those decks uninteractive. However, I want to bring to light a different idea of what interaction means inside the game of Magic. From a physical definition of an interaction is just a exchange that happens between two objects, So, for instance, if I play a creature and I attack you, the creature is an object and it interacted with you, which is a game object in the rules. And an interaction occurred, even if there is no decision. So, for instance, when we think of this, I want more interaction in my deck, right? We are not necessarily speaking about more choices, but a way to... interact on a different axis. Like a classic, interactive card is something like Abrupt Decay, which does offer choices, but it offers a unique kind of interaction in one card interacting with another card that we wouldn't necessarily be able to. I don't know really what I'm getting to or what the point of this is, but like Magic games are very interactive. Go ahead.
No, yeah, I feel like what you're saying is, there's two types of interaction in the game. There's the type of interaction where I, what people generally assume when you say an interactive card, which is a card that lets me affect what my opponent is trying to do, that being like removal or a counterspell or something along those levels. Or there's the fact that pretty much every game action in a game of Magic is somehow generally interacting with something the player is trying to do. And maybe not everything, but for the most part, every single action you do, which in essence makes creatures instead of maybe charms or something like that, the most interactive kind of spell, because they do everything. They come into play and do something, they tap, you can sack them, like literally every possible ability available, plus 1,000 more because of just the inherent ability to attack and block comes attached to a creature.
I like that you brought up creatures. I want to continue with that. I think that creatures are, the most interactive both from the, you know, decision standpoint, also from a true interactive standpoint, especially in standard. You know, I often like to play all creature decks or majority creature decks sometimes, and we look at it and we think that it's not so interactive, but like this creature with flying can block any creature, can attack a planeswalker, can attack an opponent, not just once. It can interact, you know, 10 times in a game, in a blocking axis and a attacking a planeswalker, attacking a player.
Right. I mean, on this note, I've always kind of said this. I actually think aggro and aggressive decks, or like creature heavy decks, are often more complicated to play in many facets than control decks, which is kind of the opposite of what common conception is. Yeah. And that's because there are so many different facets when I attack with a creature that I have to keep in track of, versus if I'm playing control, my main mission is, the main question I ask every turn is, should I kill this or should I let it live? And that is a much more basic question than, oh, if I attack with my three goblins, there's their one Tarmogoyf, is that able to block one of the goblins? And then am I going to be able to get enough damage in if I lose that goblin and sacrifice it? Can I somehow bluff to make him so he doesn't block? Like, there's so many different facets when attacking and blocking and doing something with creatures that they're way more complicated and definitely add way more skill level needed to kind of do well with them.
Well, I think that's an interesting point you bring up too, because talking about creatures being more interactive than spells in some ways, the biggest power creep we've seen in Magic since the beginning of the game is the power of creatures. And the power level of creatures has largely improved, not just on like rate versus mana cost, which, I mean, you have seen like 5/5s for 4 are far more common than they used to be.
Right.
But you also see so many creatures now that have an enter the battlefield ability that mimics a powerful spell, which makes it such that you can play decks like Pod, you know, old Pod and Modern. I mean, especially with high impact formats like a format like Modern, where your creature curve is going to be lower naturally, but you need interaction to be able to favorably interact with a lot of the most broken decks. You need creatures. I mean, look at Pestermite Splinter Twin. I mean, that's...
Right. Those are two creatures that are not... I mean, Kiki Jiki Splinter Twin are two creatures that just kind of go off.
They have powerful, powerful interaction while still being efficiently costed. I mean, it's just interesting. Like, the definition of interaction is so often associated with instants and sorceries rather than creatures.
Yeah. Well, also, it's so often we disassociate ourselves from being a game object. Because when I was asking this question, it was like, all right, I attack you with a creature and it deals 5 damage to you. Did an interaction happen? And a lot of people were like, no interaction happened because I didn't make a decision.
Well, but I definitely think that the interaction does happen, because look at, okay, great example. I listened back to the first episode you did with us, and you mentioned your life total as a resource when you were playing Living End with the card Street Wraith, which is a 3/4 for 5, I believe it can be cycled for 2 life. So I certainly think that your life total, even if you're just sitting there and you're making land drops and you're taking damage, you losing life is an interactive part of the game that is incredibly significant. So I think in that sense, every single game action is certainly part of interaction.
Yep. Yeah, I understand the confusion, like, because we think interaction means decision, but then from like a real, you know, physics definition, it's like just transfer of energy between objects or whatever. So, you know, it's up to definition, I guess, but...
Sure. I remember reading an article at one point. I can't remember exactly when it was written. I think it was on the Mothership. I feel like it was written by Patrick Chapin, so it could have been on Star City or something. But the idea was most perfectly designed Magic card. And he gives a whole definition in the article about, you know, what does this mean? The level, the possible level of interaction on the highest and lowest level. Lightning Bolt, I know, was in the discussion as well. But I think the argument for Giant Growth being so perfect was it can so favorably interact with so many different parts of the board. It can buff your creatures in combat, theirs, changes combat situations, can act as a burn spell if unblocked, and it's so efficient at one green at instant speed with a +3/+3 rate. It was like a great...
It's a removal spell, a defensive spell, a damaging spell, a counter spell to removal. It does like 17 different things.
In a way that you could sort of like... You could make an argument that Lightning Bolt's in the same class, but while Lightning Bolt can go to the head, Giant Growth, it can affect your creatures. It just creates a more complex board state.
Right.
So I thought that was really interesting. When if you kind of apply that, what makes that card so beautiful in terms of design for interaction, and you apply it to this concept we're having of what is interaction, is that the furthest end of the spectrum, or are you talking about something like a Kolaghan's Command is the furthest end of the spectrum?
That's the most interactive?
Yeah. Like, what are the most interactive cards in Modern? What do we think? What do you define as the most interactive
cards? Grape shot. Grape shot, 20 interactions for one card.
Yeah, okay, that's fair.
And that, yeah, that's true. I can't argue with that.
Although it's the exact opposite of many people's definition of interaction, because I had zero decision over, you know, in that game when I took 20 damage on turn two.
True, but I do like the semi trolley answer of grape shot, just because you technically are interacting more than any other card can, because you get 20 triggers off of it. So that's 20 different choices that you have to make. Theoretically. Yeah.
It's a great Robin after you win and they're like, well, that wasn't interactive at all. And you're like, that was highly interactive.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, and then you think about cards like, oh, great example, Evolutionary Leap, right? Here's a new one that's now going to be modern legal. So Evolutionary Leap ends up acting as almost like a defensive spell as well as an engine card.
Yeah, it's a card draw engine with a defensive spell. I guess in the sense that you can sack creatures to in response to what they're trying to do.
That's a very interesting level of interaction at that mana cost.
It's like instant speed birthing pod that's worse than birthing pod and better than birthing pod at the same time.
But so then chances are if you're playing it, then you're going to be getting Enter the Battlefield triggers probably, because those are probably the creatures you're playing.
Oh yeah, I mean, if you look at Kitchen Finx, that's the dream curve of that into Kitchen Finx into open mana. Like there, you're in a much better position because you basically your Kitchen Finx is 3 mana, gain 4 life, draw a card, and do any amount of damage it survives for.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Anyway, so go ahead.
I wanted to add on the giant growth. What makes a Magic card well designed? You know, I think it's important to always be aware of the flavor. Something that makes giant growth great is the name describes exactly what it does.
Yeah, I think, and it's funny too, because I can remember starting to play Magic at the very beginning of my Magic career in the mid 90s and not understanding at all why giant growth. It just was such a generic spell. I had so many of them.
See, I feel like on an interaction level though, Lightning Bolt offers, and this doesn't need to be a conversation of which is better, Giant Growth or Lightning Bolt.
Obviously, Lightning Bolt's better.
But not even better, but I mean, offers more interaction, because if I draw Lightning Bolt and I have nothing,
yeah,
then it offers me interaction ability. Where Giant Growth, when I draw it and I have nothing in play, sure, it then doesn't do anything.
Right.
So Lightning Bolt is always choices, while Giant Growth can be not a choice depending on what your board state is.
I definitely see where you're coming from with that. And I think his point, I think, was sort of more about balance. Like it's quite arguable that Lightning Bolt is a little bit overpowered, which is why it has not existed in a lot of standard environments over the last 10 years. Lightning Bolt
is overpowered. I mean, we had a conversation with Kibler,
yeah,
Brian Kibler at GP San Diego, not the one that's coming up, but one from previous.
A few years ago, yeah.
And he basically said that Lightning Bolt is one of the worst things, along with Thoughtseize, happening to Modern right now, because it basically makes it so any creature under X4 is unplayable or has to cost one mana.
That was also like 3 years ago.
Yes, but I mean, even now it's not that much different. They either have to have an immediate board presence or they have to survive Lightning Bolt. I mean, while Nakdol not being good is... Or not being good, but like being weaker than what it was expected to be, is partly just on the back of Lightning Bolt and Snapcaster Mage both existing in the format.
Both being good, yeah.
What makes Magic cards a productive, good thing for a human to do? What makes Magic cards, spending our time on this, good for society more than just fun? So I'm looking at this at a deeper level.
What's your perspective on that?
That's a tough question. And I've been thinking about that a lot. But I mean, yeah, we could look at cards and look at good as being rate over cost or whatever. But we go slightly deeper and we see, all right, people have preference. I was just in the forest watching some, you know, travelers, although as most people would call them, homeless, playing with cards. And it's like that pensive minotaur is worn to hell. That's a good card right here. Like this thing is getting some good play. But if we go even deeper, it's like, what are we actually doing? Is this a... I mean, I want to present this as a question to you all. Do you feel that this is a productive use of time? And if so, why? I'm curious. I want to know what other people's perspective is on that.
Well, I think it's a really interesting question you pose here, because I've said it on this podcast before, and I'll say it again. Like, I started playing Magic in 1995, and I've gone in and out of it my whole life. My older brother taught me to play when I was a kid, and if you just sort of like, you take that deep breath and you're in that environment, there's this very, very calm, very real presence that's not so it's not so inflated by all of these like these surface level things that seem to sort of make mm-hmm. up the world we live in, and especially in a city like Los Angeles where we live.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in that sense, magic is this wonderful bridge. If you can sort of open your mind to it, it's this incredibly modest bridge between all types of like social beings, right? You can mm-hmm. interact with so many different people if you're willing to. And I find in my position, it's always this great moment where I'll be talking to some like NFL athlete and he'll say like, mm-hmm. oh, this, that, and the other, say, well, I do a magic card podcast. Mm-hmm. Oh, what are magic cards? Well, it's this game from the 90s. It's kind of like Dungeons and Dragons meets poker and chess.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this great interaction, this great understanding now that this person who literally had no idea that it existed, I find it very interesting. So I think it's a great bridge. That's, I think, the biggest value
mm-hmm.
to me personally.
I would say I have three different kind of outlooks on the positivity mm-hmm. of magic. I guess let's start there. The first is from a educational standpoint. So if you look at a lot of people that play these games are middle schoolers, high schoolers, and from their end, there is a statistical, like, it's a fact that playing magic helps on like stuff like the SATs. And you could talk about the value of the SATs in the real world, but in reality, you're learning, you know, much better logic and reasoning. You're learning much better math, quick math skills, and like basic quick mm-hmm. math skills. And you're learning vocabulary wise for all of those sections of SATs, which, you know, an SAT word, half of magic are like weird words like coarser that like I wouldn't know otherwise, but I now know is like what it is. And if you take that kind of perspective, I think it's very helpful to some of these communities or just kids in general to kind of learn and test how their brain works to a higher function. Mm-hmm. If you go to the kind of like the next step in life, which is maybe late teens and early 20s, I do mm-hmm. think as a hobby, this is way less destructive than so many other hobbies out there. There are so many activities that I could be spending money on that A, aren't necessarily good for me, that if I, you know, I need a social interaction situation, this allows mm-hmm. me to go to my local F&M, hang out with people, have a social interaction without, you know, mm-hmm. destroying my body or wasting mm-hmm. my time or making my next day kind of shot. Another level to that is, as far as money and entertainment value goes, my kind of base level has always been a movie. So a movie costs $15 for 2 hours nice. Of entertainment. I take that same $15 and go to a magic tournament and I get 3+ hours out of it. Plus, it's possible that I make money off of it, or at least
more likely you get a 65% return on your investment.
Right, exactly. So like at least there, plus I'm still learning and I'm, you know, stretching my brain muscles and I'm like, you know, doing that kind of thing. So that's really helpful. And mm-hmm. then from the last perspective, which is kind of where I'm at in my life now, which is like more mid to late 20s, which comes with a lot of people move a lot, or they, you know, they're thrust in the new communities, or they get jobs in other locations, have to move. Right now, I feel comfortable pretty much moving anywhere in the country, at least to based off of my language, like language barriers, mm-hmm. at least to like be able to find a pretty decent community pretty quickly. I can walk into any local trading card store and like, if I show up 3 times that week or like the next couple weeks, I'll slowly, and not even slowly, I'll quickly make friends with people there. And the only other thing I can really think of that's similar to that would be like churches or like religious communities. So like the fact that that's available to a person in their 20s or late 20s or even like teenagers, if you're moving to a new city, is very valuable. At least to me it is. And I think mm-hmm. to many people, having a community like that that's easy to access is probably a good thing.
Well, certainly. And I moved here in 2010. I know you from playing Magic.
Yeah.
We didn't know each other. We've known each other 5 years. Our good friend Eric, whose wedding I was in this year, I know Eric from the first PTQ, the first pre-release I went to in 2010. It was the Rise of Eldrazi pre-release. I didn't know anybody. I went by myself. And that's one of my best friends in the world now. So I can completely relate to you there. It's a great community. And the last thing I'll add, it sort of piggybacks from your point back to mine, and we'll toss back to you, Travis, is that,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think because of the introverted nature of so many mm-hmm. Magic players, because you go into this community and you have a lot of people that this is the release, or this is the escape from, maybe it's a mm-hmm. cubicle job you work, or you're in high school, you're a college student.
Honestly.
This is thing that you get to go do. But because you're in this environment, you see a lot of people whose their level of social comfort is lower. So the kind of like judging and negative stuff that can come up in situations with a lot of introverted people, they do, and it teaches you, it does teach people to kind of rise up, stand up for themselves, band together, be supportive, mm-hmm. be positive. That's an amazing lesson you can learn if you're a young kid, especially mm-hmm. because middle school and high school, these times are very, very hard for a lot of people. There's mm-hmm. a lot of criticism and a lot of judgment, and this is largely an accepting community. So you do get examples of kind of bullying and things like that in the environment, but there's not so much of it that you can't tell right from wrong. And I think it is a great way to learn a lesson as a young person. That's something.
I think that we can all see how magic has helped ourselves. Certainly, I fall into that category of, you know, magic seems to have been good for me. But I'm definitely, my concern is that so much of my time and our time, the community's time, gets put into something that could be, in a way, escapist entertainment. Is this a black hole of time and energy? Could it be that? So I definitely want to push the idea that, okay, it's not just necessarily a social environment, but we are training our brains. And both of you touched on this a little bit. The brain is neuroplastic. This is highly documented. What that means is that thoughts and actions shape the physical structure of the brain. So we have studies on certain games and how they improve brain function. So, I mean, the processes involved in magic are diverse and extensive, but, you know, there's all kinds of quantification, balancing of risk versus reward, analyzing systems, resource management, basic math, opportunity cost, all these concepts that I get taken for granted that I have them from the moment I wake up. I sequence my day like I would cost sort my deck, you know, things like that. So I feel that it really helps me outside of the game. And I want more people to see that as it's more than escapist entertainment. You know, it's good. It could be something that's good for the world.
Yeah, I mean, well, certainly the logical reasoning component that you mentioned here is, I'm sure you've had this experience, Kessler, and Travis, I'll bet you as well, mm-hmm. where somebody says, oh, it's like Dungeons and Dragons, and you go, no, actually, it's nothing like Dungeons and Dragons. And you say to them, it really is, imagine you were the random qualities of poker. You're drawing a card a turn, essentially, mm-hmm. or you're seeing a new bit of information each sequence, and you have perfect information on the table, like chess. And then the thematics of the cards themselves are like fantasy. But if you were to replace, Rietzel touched on this last week, the famous quote, some famous pro said they wish that there were no pictures on the cards. And if you were to strip away the pictures and you were to replace the names with numbers, it would become an entire game of exactly everything you just described. Resource management, risk versus reward, quantification, numbers, and probabilities. It would just be a gigantic pile of math problems. That's the whole game.
Yes.
And for that sense, if you strip away all the Vorthos, it is just straight up math. Now, I'm not a mathematician, and I would never explain to anybody that I am. I was not particularly great at math, but that aspect of magic, the quantification aspect, is one of the things I love the most about it. And I think one of the things that gets lost on people when they try to understand what it is, they don't get that that's actually what you're learning here.
Mm-hmm.
That's what attracts people to it.
I think it's more than pure math. There's definitely some amount of art to it. Even stripping away the flavor, because there is so much choice and evolutionary trade-off where you go in this direction and you don't get an advantage necessarily because there's a trade-off. You just get, you know, there's it's not necessarily solvable like math would be, you know. So
right, well,
very artistic as well.
Definitely. And I mean, and like, that's what deck building is to a certain extent. It's taking one of the reasons, and one of the original reasons I started playing Magic, and I've mentioned this before in the cast, is Magic gives you the ability to create something and then immediately test if it's viable.
And customize your experience.
Like, the things that I gravitate to most often are the things that let me kind of customize the experience I'm going to have with it. I've been playing a lot of Werewolf recently, and I generally only like hosting the games. For those who don't know, it's a game where there's like one player who hosts everything and everyone else is playing it. And I like doing that because I get to create the experience that people are going to be playing every round. Mm-hmm. And that's what's interesting to me.
So you would have loved Dungeons and Dragons being a DM. That sounds like exactly what that is.
Yes, but that takes way too much effort before.
Just became a super nerd.
Oh, no. So one of the things that I've definitely, in regards to taking the mental processes of what magic teaches you and then applying it to the real world, and this has to do with deck building, is I am infinitely better now than I ever was before I started playing magic at taking something and then whittling it down to like the correct things. in a similar, and then this kind of comes more from EDH than I want to say even Moderate did, where like I'll just put a pile of cards on a table and then slowly get rid of the cards that are unnecessary. And I do this a little bit when I'm doing Modern Brewing, but you know, in real life, that's like, okay, we have 18 different tasks we have to accomplish. Let's make sure we focus on the correct ones. I'm much better at prioritizing what's actually important because, and I look at it as an application of the things I learned in Magic. Like, oh, like, you know, I often say kill your darlings when I'm telling people to cut cards from their decks. And that's because, you know, generally when in life, when I'm like, oh, I really want to do this, that gets it weighted priority, sometimes more than it should be. And I've learned that that's actually something that's just human nature, and to apply that to the real world.
Totally, totally. Really quickly, we do need to get into the last portion of the podcast, but we were around some Magic players last week. We had an episode last week on tournament habits of health and eating and nutrition and stuff. And we mentioned this to somebody at our local shop, and they said, you should talk to Travis about it. I watch him stream, and he's always doing push-ups and all kinds of stuff like that. Are you pretty aware of that stuff? I wasn't aware that that was like a big part. I mean, I've like looked at a ton of your deck lists, obviously, but I wasn't aware that that was a thing. I mean, tell us about that a little bit, really quickly.
Yeah, I'm definitely into health to a religious extent at times, just because I feel like, you know, this is my fleshy vehicle for life, and I only get one, and ideally I'll have a long, fun life. Applying that to Magic, as much success as I've had from tournaments, I'm pretty staunchly anti-tournament. To be honest, I don't like sitting in chairs. That's a Western thing. That's not a whole world thing. We have studies. That sucks. I'm not into sitting in chairs necessarily. So tournaments kind of go out with that. I'm not anti-Magic. It's just like my experience of Magic today, I was in the forest and met some travelers playing in the sun in the grass. It's like we live in a world where more and more and everything is online and sitting in chairs, and Magic is so amazing because you can take it outside into the forest, and that doesn't get promoted in the same way. There's a lot of that going on, but like it just, if we want to be healthy, Magic tournaments don't make a whole lot of sense, right? Like you wake up. Oh, well, there's certain health and social. Social is necessary, so that's the role that it really fulfills. But like, if you're working and you know, give up your weekend of good sleep, or you, I don't know, stay up too late on Friday, it disrupts your sleep, can disrupt your eating, and it's not really necessarily exercise, you're sitting. So I mean, the way that I try to experience Magic is ideally play outside. Obviously, I have a job where I produce Magic content, but it's like I'll be online for 1 to 2 hours a day maximum, and I'm not sitting necessarily. I'm changing postures. So I don't want to pass judgment on everyone who goes to tournaments and everyone who sits in chairs, but I feel very passionate about the great thing about Magic is it's non-digital, and we can take it outside. So let's do that.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree that it is – the human interaction aspect of Magic has always been, first and foremost in my mind, the thing that draws me to the game. And I've never played Magic online before. I've never played a single game of it. It's not something that really appeals to me, not because I think it's wrong. I mean, as you know, Paul Rietzel said last week, he doesn't ever play real-life Magic. He just plays Magic online. It's, for me, the social interaction, the actual looking into someone's face while we play a game of Magic, and the memory that gets associated with that game is a huge part of the game for me.
Well, I would also say that's I agree with you on the sense that, you know, that's something that's not brought up enough as kind of the positive PR for Magic. And often these kind of communities are kind of even lambasted at times unfairly. But I do think, like, if you compare this to World of Warcraft or any other, like, video game in general, most of those are, like, you're by yourself in your living room or bedroom or wherever you play. And you have, like, social interaction, but it's mostly just, like, how you talk to people online, which are generally the most volatile places on the planet. versus, like, a Magic store where, like, you're actually interacting with real-life people in person weekly basis. And that's, like, there are very few classic nerd, and there's bunny ears around my head right now when I say that,
we are
quotation marks.
Uber nerds. That's not a pass of judgment.
When you say that, you know, nerds that, like, isn't fair because they are interacting with people. This is like one of the few social nerd activities that are really out there that's like kind of classified even more nerdy because of it. And I think that's a really interesting facet that kind of blasts magic in kind of the wrong way. We asked our Twitter followers, and we kind of didn't even talk about this to a certain extent, but we talked about it a little bit, but I asked some of our Twitter followers just for this section, how do they classify a good Magic card? And so I'm going to read some, and if you feel free to jump in while I'm reading them, talk about how, you know, if you agree or disagree on their classifications. Mm-hmm. All right. Trevor Ramlow at Trevor Ramlow at the MMCast. If it's blue, happy face, hashtag Kappa.
Yeah, pretty much every single card that I wanted to talk about for the special cards was blue.
Right. Alexander Britt at Snapbolt Alex. Versatility and low converted mana cost.
Yep. That sounds like that versatility episode we did.
Steven Ledger at Sledger says, a high ratio of power to efficiency, Tarmogoyf, parentheses, or versatility to efficiency, the commands and charms.
Yeah.
Though I think Tarmogoyf, as we talked about earlier, gets a little not enough credit for being as versatile as it is. It can defend, it can block, it attacks. Yeah,
it's quite
it kills
good.
Creatures
it's
all the time. It's very interactive.
The argument cost versus efficiency with Tarmogoyf charms and commands referenced sounds like you're a modern player.
At StoneForgeT, kind of on this note, 2-for-1s, value, and Tarmogoyf. But we just said that Tarmogoyf is kind of a 2-for-1 because they have to jump block it.
Certainly.
Cody Smith, for me, it's a card that does what it's supposed to do well and has some sort of secondary effect not good enough on its own.
Okay. Fair enough. Yeah, that sounds like...
Every 2/2 creature for 3 that does something.
Yeah.
And last but not least, at Steve Ledger, it answers a fundamental question posed by a large percentage of the metagame. So this is kind of like what you were saying with Dispel.
Yeah, yeah.
Where, you know, Dispel in a vacuum is not very good, but as long as the metagame predates it, it's mm-hmm. really good, like it is in Modern. Their example is Blood Moon, where if we're living in a land of like 1994 Magic, where one, you know, you might have a few dual lands in your deck, but the rest are basic lands, Blood Moon is terrible. But in Modern, it's auto win at least, you know, 40% of your matches.
It's really, really, really good.
So yeah, so that's kind of the Twitter people. So yeah.
Can I give a definition for what I think makes a Magic card good?
Oh, yes, yeah, go for it.
Because I don't think I've actually done that. All right. I think a Magic card is good if it makes people excited. I think a Magic card is good for me if it makes me excited. It's not necessarily just it's more than a math problem, because if a card is like really, really, really powerful, but I'm not excited about it, it's done nothing for me. But if a card is really, really underpowered from a classical perspective, but it makes me jump out of my seat in some kind of combo, to me, that's a good card. So... I think
Summoner's Egg is a good card to you. Yes.
Yeah, it's a good card because it promotes creative processes and thinking.
Well, and that's definitely from a Magic developer or designer perspective, that's exactly what they're trying to accomplish. They care to a certain extent because they don't want things to be too powerful, more powerful, but they care that things are exciting. They want the grand architects and the Geist of St. Traffs and the Summoner's Eggs to exist for different players, because then they're excited. Oh, Vengevine, he comes back to the graveyard. You can get like 4. It's like a 4/3 with haste. That's card's nuts. That gets me excited. Yeah. It doesn't matter that it sees X amount of play in a specific format. It matters more that, it matters that I start buying packs, but B, that I'm just excited to get a hold of one for the first time.
Yeah, I think the emotional effect of a card is really important. The inverse is like, is Jace the Mind Sculptor a good card in Standard? It made a lot of people miserable. It made some people excited, certainly, but that had a negative effect. So it was Jace a good card for Standard, right?
I would argue no.
No, Standard, definitely not. That it was way too powerful. That card's awesome. I mean, yeah, it's a relative term, because I'm with you. I'm with you, Travis. Yeah. Like I'm similar to you in the sense that generically, like for instance, the whole Modern PPTQ season, I refused to play Alex's fully formed Abzan deck, even though it's just a really good deck of like, it's a big stack of rares. And I just was like,
Lingering Souls is uncommon. All right.
Because for me, like they're all really good cards. That's just not, those weren't cards that I wanted to play Magic with. Not that I don't think they're good. They're just not good for me. I don't pick them up and I don't get excited. So in that sense, you know, and those are the different kinds of players. You talk about stripping away the pictures and you just, that boil to numbers. That's just spikes want to do that. Guys like me, who are kind of in the middle. I want to win, but I need to win with my own cards. It has
called
to be
a Johnny.
Yeah, it's called a Johnny. You have to win. You know, I have to win with Genie? An idea I that yeah. I think is cool. So
I do want to thank you, Travis. Can you tell everyone where to find you on the internet?
Yeah, on Facebook and Twitter, Travis Wizard right now. Also on Facebook, I'm building and promoting these deck building groups. I've got two of them, Deck Building Wizardry and Magic Deck Crafting for Good. If you type that in the top bar on Facebook, Magic for Good and Deck Building Wizardry, those are good places to post your deck lists.
Could you really quick talk about kind of what those two things are, what those two groups are?
Yeah, those groups are for a place to post decks and get feedback and give feedback, and where it's kind of intentionally productive, positive environment.
Okay, great. That's wonderful. That's definitely something. I mean, I know a lot of the people, we get a lot of deck lists, so it's definitely a good place for everyone to kind of go and get good feedback. Thanks for kind of posting about where that would be. As always, you can find me at Kes Wiley on Twitter.
You can find me at Ben Bateman Media on Twitter and Instagram.
You can find the podcast, and please follow and tweet at us at the MMCast. And we are also, you know, I want to remind you guys to go check out our sister podcast, The Command Zone. They are also on rocketjump.com. They do awesome Commander content with Jimmy and Josh. And we will see you guys next week.
Yeah, check out some of our recent episodes and the upcoming ones, guys. We got some, like, I don't, we got really lucky or something, and like some really, really cool people like yourself and a few other pros seem to think that we're a worthwhile podcast to do. So check out some of the recent ones and the upcoming ones. There's also some kind of new developments in the works that I think you guys will like. So we will see you next week. And thank you again so much, Travis, for coming by and talking to us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I hope that I did a good job.
Yeah, you were great, man. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you for your attention. For further inquiries, send an email to the mmcast@rocketjump.com. See you later, alligator.